last 5 years, in the midst of what some would call the sort of mental health crisis that we face with college students, was this challenge on campus that you literally could not hire enough counselors to deal with the clinical needs that students were presenting. The framework we use is around well-being. In other words, how do we create higher levels of well-being among students? And that will be an upstream solution that will result in fewer downstream clinical challenges that young people would have.
Welcome back to Season 4 of Education Empowered. Joining the show today and here to help us kick off a new season is Kevin Krueger. Kevin is the president and CEO of the National Association of Student Personnel Administrators, also known as NASPA. He boasts more than 40 years of experience in higher education, 26 of which he has spent in various leadership roles at NASPA. Kevin has published and presented globally on trends in higher education, student success, degree completion strategies for low-income and first-generation students, and change management and leadership in higher education. Today, he joins Education Empowered host Jason Belland to share some of his wisdom. Kevin and Jason discuss wellness as it relates to students, staff, and faculty alike, how institutions can best address growing mental health challenges, and the intersection of well-being and equity in education. Plus, Kevin shares what trends in the ed sector he is most excited for in 2021. Enjoy this episode. Kevin touches on a lot today, but for an additional dive into the latest trends in higher education, check out the Global Higher Education Research Snapshot from Salesforce.org. This snapshot covers everything from top insights on student well-being and trust to changing academic goals and more. Find the paper at sfdc.co/education-empowered-trends. That's sfdc.co/education-empowered-trends. And now I'll hand it off to your host, Jason Belland.
Hey, everyone. Thanks so much for being with us today. I'm Jason Belland, Vice President of Industry Solutions for Salesforce Education Cloud. Well, it is episode 1 of season 4 of the podcast. Who would have thought that we would have made it this far? And it's awesome. We've got a great season planned for you. And I'm so grateful to have all of you here listening to what I think is going to be a really great conversation with a gentleman named Kevin Krueger. He's the president and CEO of NASPA, National Association of Student Personnel Administrators. This is my first time, Kevin. This is our first time having a conversation.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, nice to meet you, Jason.
Yeah, great to meet you. And I felt like I sort of met you yesterday because I was internet stalking, basically, in preparation. But, you know, I had one of these moments. I have a lot of these moments. I'm fortunate that I have a lot of great moments in my life. And one of them is anytime I feel kind of discouraged about the state of the world or just how are we going to get through whatever we're facing in higher ed, I stumble upon a conversation with someone like yourself on another podcast I was listening to or others in around us. And I get really excited and inspired about what we could do together as we keep working together and the work you're doing really focused on student services and how we support the whole student is just critical to that. So thanks for the inspiration. You know, I don't know that everyone is familiar with the work you're doing. Do you want to just maybe start off just talking to us a little bit about your work at NASPA?
NASPA is a professional association. We serve about 15,000 student affairs professionals across the U.S. Also, we're international and global, represent about 35 countries. Student affairs is a part of the university that's sort of the out-of-class experience. So if you sort of think about the classic university, you have faculty who manage the academic side, and then we manage sort of all the out-of-class part of the institution. So, you know, a lot of the kind of high-profile things that are going on right now in the middle of the COVID crisis, you know, how we keep students safe on campus, how we engage with them virtually, all the mental health issues, all the contact tracing and testing and plans around all that, that sort of falls in student affairs. You know, but without the pandemic, we are really, you know, focused on student success. How do we help students be successful in their college career with a particular lens on equity? How do we do that, recognizing that there are significant gaps between those who achieve college degrees and then those who don't, and trying to reduce some of those barriers?
That's amazing work. And before we jump into kind of some of the challenges that we're facing today, I'd love to kind of maybe have you tell us a little bit about how you've been in NASPA for a while, but has your entire professional career been in higher ed?
Tell you a quick story. I got into this whole business of the student affairs work through being dissatisfied with my college major. Actually, I was a history, political science, and social studies education major. So I wanted to be a teacher, teach 10th grade social studies. And I did my student teaching at the University of Albany in a local high school, 10th grade social studies. And I realized after, I don't know, maybe a day that 10th graders actually weren't very interested in social studies. It was kind of an uphill climb. And at the end of that quarter, I kind of like rethought things a little bit. I thought, geez, I don't know if I want to do this. These students don't seem very interested. Of course, I had the whole thing going on. I had a jacket with like elbow patches and everything. I was really into the whole role.
That's great.
But at the time, I was also involved in some student affairs leadership stuff. I was a resident assistant in the residence hall. I was an orientation advisor. And I went to my hall director and said, how do you get to do this job? And basically, he said, oh, you got to get a master's degree. And here's the work and yada, yada, yada. So in the end, I got in sort of because I maybe couldn't hack it as a socialized teacher, maybe. But I realized that I had a love for teaching, and the teaching instead was going to be with college students, and rather than the classroom, in the out of class laboratory of their lives. And so I actually wanted to be a vice president of student affairs and was heading in that direction, but then got sidetracked to this work in NASPA, and I've been now coming up on my 26th year. And what I love about NASPA is the ability to work on issues that cut across all institutions and to really solve big problems that are that higher education has. And I really find that to be interesting. It's constantly changing and kind of grabs my attention.
What a great journey you've had. That's really great. Thanks for sharing that. And I'm visualizing you now with the blazer, with the patches. Mm-hmm. So I'm excited. This kind of maybe pivots to the next question I want to dig into about some of the challenges that you are seeing and that we are all seeing across the board as we work with higher education institutions. And that is around well-being. You know, we're really seeing that as a top challenge identified by students, by faculty, and importantly by staff as well, as we think about how do we support everybody here in the current climate. I've been excited's the wrong word. I've been energized by, I've been inspired by how there's been a real focus on wellness. And it's unfortunate maybe the pandemic brought us to this, but just the focus on supporting the whole student outside of the classroom has been really great to see from schools really stepping up, thinking about what are our values as institutions and how can we leverage our technology, our people, our ideas to really make sure every student is getting what they need right now. So it's been great to see that happening. This feels like a great moment for higher ed in terms of really thinking about the whole student. I'd love to hear from your perspective what you're seeing at NASPA in terms of student well-being.
Yeah, so I'd say maybe, Jason, over the last 5 years, maybe a little longer, in the midst of what some would call the sort of mental health crisis that we face with college students, which is really sort of this gradual uptick in the number of students with serious psychological disorders, increase in number of students who have general anxiety, depressive disorders. We can go into more of that later. What it created, though, was this challenge on campus that you literally could not hire enough counselors to deal with the clinical needs that students were presenting. So you have to take sort of a public health kind of view of this one, and the way the framework we use is around well-being. In other words, how do we create higher levels of well-being among students? And that we think will kind of be an upstream solution that will result in fewer downstream clinical challenges that young people would have. Now, you're still going to need counselors, but we think that some of the issues around resilience and well-being and flourishing are, if you can give students those skills, many of these sort of day-to-day kind of normal life transition kinds of things can be managed by a better sense of efficacy that students can develop. And so that's really been a real focus. And you've seen across higher education all over the country, this expansion of well-being programs and helping students, again, develop those abilities. You mentioned kind of holistic. I think that's really the key to it, because it's really looking at students, not just their one slice of who they are, but really kind of holistically. So for example, we want to look at their nutrition. What are they eating? Can we educate them about that? about sleep, about exercise, about stress management or using mindfulness. In some cases, their spiritual well-being. And what we discovered, obviously, financial well-being would be another factor. So you sort of look at this sort of broad, holistic view. What you get then is a view of students that that allows them to work on developing sort of these skills, this competency in these different areas that will serve them well into their adult life, right? So this, but it also has the impact of reducing some students need to have clinical services. It's a real powerful tool for us. It's really the only solution long-term, because if we still start seeing this kind of increase in the number of students who come with mental health issues, we've got to do something, again, on the preventive side upstream. And we can talk more about it, but it's a very exciting kind of development in higher education, and one I think that students are really relating to. It gives them the control, again, that self-efficacy about how they can manage their own lives and make improvements there.
That's great. And Kevin, I'm curious, are you seeing similar things or different kinds of approaches across the broader institution community in terms of faculty and staff and well-being?
That's a good question. Let's just identify that the pandemic has been a major source of stress, and we're also seeing increases in mental health challenges for our faculty and staff. That could be said for all of America as we're dealing with this, you know, kind of this incredible crisis here. But certainly student affairs staff, the ones that I work with, the very ones who are actually working with students in wellness, I think probably can have adapted some of those behavioral changes. So there's probably some learning along the way. I think the difference is for faculty and staff right now, and you're really seeing this right now in the current media, the sort of tension between the institution that they work at, their interest in being open to whatever degree they can be open in terms of live classes or having students in the residence halls, and what that means in terms of the faculty and staff who have to then be on the front line with those mm-hmm. students, some of whom don't always use the best judgment about how they are managing the pandemic. So I think that's one thing. And then I think, you know, if you look collectively at higher education, between hiring freezes and furloughs and layoffs, I think it's put a lot of pressure on the faculty staff contingent. And in terms of the number of hours worked and the pressure and the pressure to perform and a variety of those kinds of things. So I would say in some ways, we're a little bit more organized about how we do it with students and a little less focused on how we're managing the same issues for faculty and staff. One last thing I just want to mention, though, we often think about this as being an issue for traditional first-time, full-time, or traditional-age college students. What we're seeing in the data is that this is also becoming a major issue for graduate students. In fact, we're seeing levels of depression among graduate students twice in 2020 than it was in 2019. Wow. So it's no surprise, right? The graduate students were, you know, last year were undergraduates or 2 years ago. So, you know, it's not like they suddenly have moved away from all their mental health challenges, but we are seeing more and more cases and across the professional, you know, all graduate levels of more mental health issues. So this is something that really involves the ecosystem of students, faculty, and staff at the institution.
My observation from working with our customers around the world is student affairs professionals tend to be amazing, mission-driven people who are in the business of helping mm-hmm. individuals succeed, who want to do the right thing. It's on top of a pandemic that's impacting all of our lives in different ways. It can be really challenging to now have to maybe I to help students or support them, but have to do so in a virtual environment.
I think you're right. I think they're very mission-driven, very, very, you know, it's a very committed group, and also a group that is, you know, can be kind of subject to some burnout. Mm-hmm. There was an interesting article in the Chronicle of Higher Education last week about this very issue. And the title of the article was hashtag Team No Sleep. And they were talking about the student affairs people. So you kind of get a sense of the kind of pressures there. But your question also suggested sort of this pivot to online and the virtual virtual world. So every higher education institution story is a little different. In the beginning, everybody was remote, but you did see, you know, faculty and staff coming in, student affairs staff coming back to campus because if there were going to be students on campus, you got to be where they are. So not every student affairs person has the ability to work remotely. But either way, even if students were in the residence hall, you know, we've de-densified the residence halls and classes are largely online, even if they're, you know, some of them are hybrid. It has necessitated, as you've suggested, sort of expanding the virtual ways in which we engage with students. And that's probably, you know, so you were talking in the very beginning about being optimistic. One of the things I'm optimistic about is we probably did, you know, maybe 5 years of work in 5 months in terms of beginning to develop and really fully develop a more robust online engagement platform for working with students. And so I think that will pay off later on. So, you know, just going back to that well-being conversation we had, you know, campuses doing, you know, things around nutrition or online Zumba classes or, you know, recreation efforts, you know, things like that, engaging students in that remote space, creating spaces to show movies or music, live music, and have students in audience, a variety of things that, you know, we probably wouldn't have seen earlier. And then on the counseling side, you know, virtually, you know, historically, you know, when you see a counselor, you see that person face to face. 5 years ago, in the data around counseling center directors, only 5% of counseling center directors were using any kind of online or virtual modules for counseling. Today, in 2020, and now 2021, almost every higher education counseling center is using online counseling or telecounseling in the same way that physicians have done the same in the medical community. So again, that was a trend that probably would have taken, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5 years to develop it fully. And now within the span of several months, we have implemented fairly robust telecounseling options. Now there's some licensure issues, which we won't get into now, that are trying to be resolved between states. But the reality of trying to develop counseling modalities online has been a really important advance. And I think what it will do is remove some barriers that that some students would have faced around the stigmatization about going to the counseling center. I mean, you know, you don't have to be seen going anywhere. Or, you know, let's say you had a full-time, you were working full-time and going to school and you wanted to see a counselor. Well, you couldn't do that given the time constraints. Or as we know, some students from different cultures have more stigmatization. For example, international students have a lot more stigma about mental health services than American students. So my point is, that's a really positive development as you think about providing more access to psychological services that could be done on a remote and virtual way.
And by the way, I'm still thinking about the online Zumba class that you... Which maybe is something that should die with the pandemic at some point.
Probably.
I think I've thought about doing kind of some of these online yoga classes or things, but I haven't brought myself to it yet. But my dog is probably thankful that I'm not doing that. But more seriously, have we crossed some sort of threshold here when it comes to telehealth, telecounseling, where students are going to expect this now? And that I mean, it really resonated with me thinking about, you know, the stigmatization, thinking about all of the things that you mentioned. You know, is it now an expectation, and is it now something a must have for schools, and is it now opening up these kind of interesting, kind of deeper, more engaged conversations with students because we can kind of meet them in a medium that maybe better, that they're more comfortable with?
I think that, like a lot of things that have happened in this last, you know, 11 months or so, we're not going to go back to the way it was in almost any aspect of our society. This has forced us to do, as a global community, lots of different things differently. And this is a good example. I don't see us going back to a time when we say, well, we're not going to do telecounseling anymore, any more than we're not going to do telemedicine anymore. I think these things now, that from a consumer standpoint, the consumer wants some of that convenience and or whatever the issues are related to that. I think that will be part of the toolbox that campuses have in terms of how they connect to students, really in the mental health space. But I wouldn't just leave it to telecounseling. I think there's nothing like being in person. If you're a traditional age student and you're joining an organization, you go to an organization meeting of some sort, you know, those kinds of things that will continue after the pandemic. But I think that what we now know is that we can reach perhaps more students or different kind of students.
Yeah.
In a whole variety of engagement opportunities. And I think that we'll hold on to that. You know, here's a great example. The Career Center, and every campus has a Career Center. If you think about the world around us, what's more important than a student going to college and having a successful career? Is the connection that is the most cemented for both families, the public, and the students themselves? Very few students visit the Career Center and are happy with the services of the Career Center. I mean, the Career Center staff will always tell you they, you know, they get students to come to the Career Center for these resume workshop by offering free pizza, not because the resume workshop was good and has a value in and of itself. So I think it's useful to think about, well, how would we think about creating connections around workforce development and do that in a virtual world as opposed to face-to-face? And might we get more students connected that way? Let's say you have a student who's interested in bioengineering. It's going to be a lot easier to connect them to potential mentors and people in the field in a virtual setting than having them have to go visit and do a, you know, informational interview. So I think there's lots of ways that we can kind of expand the portfolio of ways that we interact with students. You know, that's a positive thing. And that's a good example of us not going back, right? We're not going to stop doing stuff virtually. At the same time, if you look at kind of what's the one of the takeaways we have about these last 11 months, it's that the face-to-face, in-person, on-campus experience has a huge value, and we're not going to want to just do away with this. This is not the end of brick-and-mortar institutions or colleges, we know it. In fact, what we've seen is it's reinforced how important that live face-to-face work is, particularly, again, for that coming-of-age, traditional-age college student. So, you know, it's going to be that kind of mix, and we're going to have to find the right mix going forward.
I love that. And by the way, just a note on career services, we've had some really interesting conversations over the last 6 months to a year with career services professionals, really kind of reimagining their offices as a career strategy office and really aligning with the student. So that's been just amazing. And then actually in preparation for this interview, I encountered this booklet that I'd been given in 1998 from my career services office in my final year of college. And it was, hey, you know, here's career services now that you've got a few months left and here's how you write a resume and everything. And it's just, it's great to see that that's not happening as much. And there's an evolution.
You might be aware that Strata found Educational Services has been doing these COVID surveys. And the one they did in December ask students two questions. Is college worth the cost? Mm-hmm. And how would you rate your college or university's support for helping students connect their education to a meaningful career? So not the career services office, but the career process, right? And it's a linear relationship. The higher a student rates their institution's ability to connect their education to a meaningful career, the more they think college is worth the cost. So 83% of students who think that the college was excellent at connecting their education to a career, 83% of them said the college is worth the cost. Mm. When they think the university did a poor job of making that connection, only 17% think it's worth the cost. So there's a message here for us about, you know, just on this one point, I want, as you dig into this with other folks, I think there's a real message here about how critically important it is to make those connections. And it can't be the career services office. It's got to be like from admissions, mm-hmm. admissions, orientation, advising, the whole process should be about how students' investment in their college is going to pay off to some sort of successful career and workforce connection.
Yeah, I'm totally aligned with you on that. Absolutely love that how you're thinking about it. You know, I just want to touch on you've mentioned this in different ways throughout, but just want to give you maybe an opportunity to. We've talked about supporting different learners here, but I'd love to kind of just hear from you a little bit more about this intersection between a focus on well-being and issues around equity and access.
One thing we know for certain, if anybody's working in higher education, is that equity has been severely challenged through that pandemic. I mean, it's a huge conversation. We could do a whole podcast on this, but let me just kind of highlight a couple of things. One is if you look at the National Clearinghouse data, we see that among first-time, full-time students who graduated high school and came to college, big drop-offs all over the country, but the biggest drop-offs were from high-poverty high schools, high-minority high schools, high schools in the lowest-income areas. And so we see income and race in particular having a huge impact on students' ability to get into college this year. So that's a big story that has an equity consequence. On the well-being side, Wake Forest University has been leading this well-being collaborative. It's about 36 institutions. They all take the same set of students take the same set of questions. It's a big kind of data set. They have discovered some really challenging dimensions around well-being. For example, that the more marginalized identities a student identifies with, 1, 2, 3, or 4, the less their well-being is. In fact, you can kind of linearly graph it. one to two to three to four, and just keeps going down. That's a reminder that we see disproportionate impacts from mental health on some of our most historically minoritized communities. Another data set looks at general anxiety and depressive disorders since the pandemic. Let's say around a third of students saying they've had kind of a increase in general anxiety. And then you look at down the line demographically, where is it higher than a third? It's low-income students, Black students, Latinx students, non-binary students, GLBT students. So again, very important as we look at all these well-being and mental health initiatives to understand that these are disproportionately affecting some of our most marginalized and minoritized communities. Lots of reasons for that, but if you look at where the data around where which communities have lost income or lost their jobs, we see that the Latinx community and the Black community in America have had a higher job loss and loss of income. That then creates a challenge for those students, the students in that family, to get to college, or even if they do get there, some of the stress and anxiety about being in college when you have your family's suffering from a major financial loss. Again, we saw a lot of challenges around housing and food insecurity that cropped up during the pandemic that we think are directly related to some of those environmental conditions that students are growing up in. So, a story that I have not seen really told very much in the trade publications. Is we almost have a not a generation, but certainly a cohort of young students, Latinx students, Black students, Indigenous students, low-income students who didn't get to college this year because of the pandemic. Well, what's going to happen to that cohort? Do we lose them forever? Can we get them back next fall? Can we get them back this spring? And is this trend one we're going to see next fall as well? So issues around affordability and equity, I think, are going to be ones that we're going to really have to grapple with, because there already was a divide. Let's hope that we can kind of not have that divide get greater as a result of the pandemic. And it seems right now that it is.
Yeah, and it's, I guess, one thing to be grateful for here is all of the data that we have that's inviting these very real and serious discussions in our community. So
yeah, I was listening to the news this morning, and not to get into the political debate, but there was a conversation about the stimulus bill that the Biden administration is proposing, and the Republicans are like, well, show us the data that this extra $1.9 trillion would work. Well, in the higher ed kind of parallel world, we have that data. You're right. We have the data that clearly says we're going to lose a generation of students if we don't take action to create more opportunities for access and affordability. And I know there's a lot of discussion around free college, which I know is controversial. And we just note that for students, for example, going to a community college who are Pell eligible, it's not the cost of tuition that is the barrier to entry. In fact, we saw that this fall, it wasn't, the tuition isn't so always the barrier. It's everything else that students have to pay for. Mm-hmm. It's books, it's transportation, it's the opportunity cost of not working. It's a variety of other things that that go into this. So when we look about affordability, we have to make sure we're looking holistically. It's not just about tuition, although it's certainly tuition is a factor.
That's great to call that out. And it just reminds me of so many inspirational stories that I've heard from either, folks in the provost office, directors of advisors themselves, where they've been able to get some signal from data that they have across various systems across campus that's alerted them to something that's not academically related, food insecurity, other, and they've been able to reach those students before there was more of a serious issue. And so, grateful that we've got these amazing people in our community who are doing that work, but that we can surface that data.
Over the last 5 years, the leveraging of data analytics to serve the individual student is really, I think it's the future of higher ed. I mean, if we're going to be constrained on resources, we need to put the resources we do have, the students who need us the most, right? So, and I think that some of the data analytics that's available to us now allow that kind of pivot, which I think is going to be awesome.
Yeah, no, totally. And I'm seeing more and more, really driven from innovators in provosts and others, other academic leaders, really pushing on, hey, everybody, we are stewards of the data across the student experience. Career doesn't own a data versus somebody else versus admissions. We all have to have a shared understanding holistically of the student so we can equitably serve them. And so that's been really, really exciting to see. You're looking at a lot of members, a lot of conversations that you're having to bring these thoughts together. I imagine this last year's maybe has been somewhat challenging for you too. I'm curious, how are you connecting with your membership and engaging mm-hmm. your members, maybe mm-hmm. even using technology to do that?
Yeah, well, there's a lot of parallels to how the association community surviving the pandemic to how higher ed is as well. So, you know, just as a quick reference point, we on March 7th, and we looked ahead the rest of 2020, we had 70 live events planned, one as large as 8,000, some as small as, 100 or 200, and we canceled them all. It's sort of like, well, how do you as an organization, meet the needs of your members when you've canceled everything? So obviously, just like higher ed, we moved to virtual platforms. What didn't change was the interest, hunger, desire to connect with other people who are doing what they're doing and also to learn from experts around this. So we had tremendous success in online, pivoting to online. We would initially would do events for, 1,500, 2,000, 2,500 people for free. And so the big thing I want to say for us is what we know is that given how tight institutional dollars are now, we know that price and cost is a real challenge for professionals. So we made a decision that was much more important to stay close to our members and not worry about how much we're charging or if we're charging at all. So we've kept things at a very low cost. Some of my colleagues, other associations differ. They feel like, well, that decreases the value of what you're offering. For us, it was, knowing student affairs and knowing the budgets we have, we really wanted to keep things low cost. So just a good example, our annual conference, which is coming up in March, we would normally charge, $495. It's a 3-day event. We get 8,000 people. We're charging $59. And we did that because we didn't want cost to be a barrier to people participating in the biggest professional event in the world for student affairs. So that was the way kind of we did that. And then, of course, as the pandemic goes on, as we kind of ease out of it, we'll start morphing into to more live events. But like higher education, I think associations will see a permanent change to, instead of doing everything in person, I think we're going to see a lot more robust online learning opportunities that maybe would have taken us a few more years to develop fully. So I think we've accelerated that as well.
Yeah, that's great. I was just thinking about even at Salesforce, we, of course, canceled a number of events, mm-hmm. and some of my favorite events, bringing thousands of higher ed IT folks and administrators and student affairs professionals together. We had to cancel a number of them. And we had these amazing online events as a replacement. And it does raise a question about what does the future look like? Because there's so many folks who were able to attend our events this year who wouldn't have otherwise, the plane ticket, the hotel, all the things you have to do, the time away, all those things. Obviously, I can't wait to shake somebody's hand again and just see a human being. But I also want to make sure we're engaging with the broader community. And so it's exciting to think about what the future might look like when what is the and scenario where we're doing the online as well as some of the in-person?
If we do a conference, no matter the size, and we ask people afterwards to evaluate the experience and so on and so forth, it's never the sessions they went to or the keynotes. It's always the networking. The networking is always the number one outcome that people talk about when they go to a meeting. And so that tells us something about the power of kind of human interaction. It's why I just tend to be a person that doesn't believe that brick and mortar college universities are going away. People want that in-person thing. Same thing for associations. There's something magical about being in a face-to-face, the hallway conversations, the group conversations. You can have that sense of community that comes together. Having said that, you identified something that I think is really important, and that is not everybody has the resources to get to, jump on a plane and go to a hotel or take the time away from work or family, whatever it might be. So from an access standpoint, one of the things the pandemic has done is it's really allowed us to reach a much wider audience with high quality professional development at low or no cost. So I think it's going to be a really fun challenge to think about what's the mix of that going forward and what does a hybrid association look like? So we keep the best parts of our in-person learning, but then we also make sure that there's lots of and expanded learning opportunities that are virtual that create opportunities for folks who don't have the same resources or privilege to be able to go to an in-person meeting.
Yeah. No, I love it. And I think for others I've talked to, just the notion of being more intentional about how we're using our time, just in really appreciating those in-person interactions where you're with somebody and how do we best use that?
Jason, I think you're right. I think the next time we are able to come together, you know, next Salesforce conference, next NASPA conference, we certainly won't be cavalier about the precious opportunities we have to connect people while we're there. So I think that's going to make our meetings actually better. And I think that will be a good thing. I think the other thing we all have to grapple with, and maybe it'll certainly feel differently once we come out of the pandemic, but there isn't a person that I have talked to who does the kind of work that we do, that isn't just so fried from staring at the computer. Yeah. It's just the way it is. I mean, you know, I come upstairs at the end of the day, my wife, will see me come up after, you know, 7, 8, 9, 10 hours of being down here. And she's like, I've never seen you so exhausted. And that sentiment of exhaustion, I hear across my industry, because we're all kind of operating in the same space. So I think the other thing that we've come to understand is that if you are, you know, doing this remote work all of the time, has its own set of challenges. And I think that, again, we need to find that, you know, that kind of mix a little bit. And, you know, we're student affairs people, we're huggers. So we don't want to just shake hands. We are like, it is going to be a hug fest when we all get together. A lot of people I talk to are like, I cannot wait to get to a meeting and just see people again and have conversations. So it's going to be a little bit of that. People are going to be hungry for that going forward.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Kevin, we're just about out of time here. This has been awesome talking with you. I'd love to kind of just, maybe land on one question, you know, your vision for the future, if you will. We've talked a little bit about this anyway, but just kind of if there's some thoughts you can think about, you know, what are you excited about going in next year?
I want to leave in a sense of optimism, but look, but higher ed has a lot of challenges ahead of us. But the community college sector, because of enrollment, just buffeted. So difficult times there. Mm-hmm. When state revenue coffers are, you know, kind of reconciled for 2020, we're going to see state cuts to higher education like we saw in 2008, 2009. Can be tough budgetary times. We've got these access and equity issues that we're going to have to resolve. But I think from a sense of optimism, that higher education was going to need to have made some changes. It made it faster than they needed to. I think the remote and the virtual learning opportunities are going to allow us to serve more students, to lean up a little bit. I think the data analytics we talked about and some of the data sets that we know we have access to are going to force us to really focus our resources on the students who need us the most. I say in some of my speeches, like, we need to really make the hard decision about putting resources that students need us the most and a little less on the students that don't need us as much. And that's, mm-hmm. We don't like to say that publicly, but that's going to help serve students. And I would love to see institutions also, particularly our four-year institutions, make more progress away from merit-based aid and more towards need-based aid, so that we can begin addressing some of these critical problems around affordability. But I'm optimistic. We've got good, committed people. I work with college presidents all the time, and vice presidents and provosts, and these people care about, you know, the students that they're entrusted with, and want them to make degree progress, graduate, get a job. I think we've got the right mix that will make this next 5 or 10 years some of our best years in higher education.
You know, I agree with that, Kevin. I've been working in higher ed for my entire career, and I've never been as enthusiastic and as excited about where we are and where we're going than I am right now. This has really just brought out some great energy and leaning into the, like, what is our mission? Why are we here? And how do we just get through some of the things that have been blocking us in the past and get stuff done? So this is a beautiful moment for all of us.
Agreed. Yeah.
Awesome meeting you and chatting with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Jason.
I'd love to, we should reconnect at some point and just kind of see how things are going as we kind of go through this year together. But this has been really great. So thanks for taking the time.
My pleasure. I would enjoy that. You take care, Jason. Be well.
Thanks so much. And thanks to all of you for listening today for episode 1, season 4. Huge success with our good friend, Kevin Krueger. Looking forward to sharing more on this great season we have planned on episode 2 and beyond. Thanks so much. Take care, everyone.
Thanks for tuning in to another episode of Education Empowered. Are you looking for the latest in higher education research? Check out the Global Higher Education Research Snapshot from Salesforce.org for top insights on student well-being, trust, and more. Learn more at sfdc.co/education-empowered-trends. That's sfdc.co/education-empowered-trends.